He comes back and he finds out they've hung 19 people. And he's like, "What? This is not what I had in mind."
Hi, this is Shannon.
And Kristen, or better known as
the Vonal Twins. Yay!
Woohoo!
In honor of our spooky season, we are taking you to Salem. We will be exploring one of the most fascinating and infamous periods in American history, the Salem Witch Trials. Today, the Salem Witch Trials remain a powerful symbol of the dangers of superstition, intolerance, and mob mentality, and continue to capture our imagination and fascination. So let's dive into the history of witches in Salem and explore the myths, facts, and the legacy of this dark chapter in American history with your favorite spooky guest, Troy Taylor.
So Troy is an acclaimed author and historian who has made a career out of exploring the dark corners of American history. With over 130 books to his name, Troy is a true master of the art of storytelling, and his work spans a wide range of topics from true crime and hauntings to legends and folklore. His books have been praised for their thorough research, gripping narratives, and chilling details, making him a favorite among readers and fans. In this episode, we'll be discussing One Night in Salem, the gripping and insightful book by Troy Taylor that offers a new perspective on the Salem witch trials and the events leading up to them and the history of witchcraft in America.
Troy! It's so nice to see you again!
I know, this has to make it
one. It's been ages.
I know. Oh my God. I'm so excited to have you back on. We told you this off mic, but like every single person, when we tell them spooky season is coming, happening, they go, first response is Troy.
It should just be Troy season.
At this point.
It's not spooky season.
It's not spooky
Troy
season. It's the month of fangirling over Troy Taylor. It's so nice to have you on.
I know it's become an annual tradition, and so I look forward to it. I always know, I never know what we're going to talk about. So I get the invite, and it's like, you know, it's an invite, and I'm like, I don't know why you're inviting me, because you know I'm going to do it. It's always this straight laced professional invite, and I'm like, are they mad at me or something? I just would expect a text message that says, hey, we need to record. When do you want to do it? So, and here's what it's about, you know, and I go, okay, you know, so yeah.
To be fair, I'm trying to be professional so I don't, you know, overstep our friendship, you know, like I could easily text and be like, hey, Troy, we're doing an episode. Let's go. I'm happy to do
when
it.
When do you want to do it?
Exactly. No, I know. Well, I'm honestly just so excited about this new book that you just wrote. It is so freaking amazing. I can't honestly wait to get into it. But I have to ask, obviously, what inspired you to write One Night in Salem? Mm-hmm. And what was your research process like in uncovering the details of this infamous event?
Yeah.
Well, the thing about the main thing about this book is to, one thing, dispel the idea that there were actual witches in Salem. These were innocent people that were executed because of the Puritans and their religious fanaticism, you know, and their fear of actual witchcraft. And, you know, I mean, pop culture has changed it so that now when we think of Salem, we immediately think of witches. And, and there weren't any witches there, but I mean, now there are, but there weren't. And so we've had everything kind of upended with American Horror Story and all these different shows that have portrayed there being witches in Salem. And a lot of people who are witches today will, you know, claim lineage back to Salem. And I'm thinking, okay, don't do that, because those people were not witches. So that doesn't really, you know, give you more credibility, at least in my book. But the thing about it was, so I'm looking at the story, and it becomes the title of the book, because it's something everyone is familiar about. You know, you hear Salem and you immediately think witchcraft, and you think America, Massachusetts, everything. But you know, I guess my thing was, is that since there weren't any witches there, how did this happen? You know, how did people get so, you know, freaked out about the idea that there were witches in town that caused all these things to happen? So what I wanted to do was to look at the history before and after, and really the history of witchcraft in America in general. So I wanted to look at how it ended up here, what happened. So I kind of started to dig into, you know, all the different kinds of folk magic that were just ordinary people that did fortune telling, you know, healing, that kind of thing, and became known as witches or the cunning folk. And there was a lot of different names for them. But a lot of them came to our country from England and Wales and Ireland, Scotland, Germany, I mean, even Africa, bringing these ideas there. But when they got to this country, what they were in Europe became something completely different when it got here and took root. And so that's kind of what I wanted to explore. You know, I wanted to dig into that and see, you know, what it was all about. And to be able to do that, I had to do a lot of research, which you know I love, because this is not my normal genre. I mean, you know, I write about ghosts and true crime mostly, so witchcraft was way outside of my normal purview. So I did a lot of research. I dug through a lot of old newspapers, read a lot of books. You know, I did a lot of traveling because I wanted to meet some people to give me a better idea, because I am no expert on this. You know, I wanted to meet people who actually were, at least in their niche. So I did a lot of traveling, mostly pre-COVID, but afterward too, over several years. And I met real witches, people who actually claim to be witches, folk healers, hex magic practitioners in Pennsylvania, hoodoo doctors, voodoo priests. I mean, I went to voodoo ceremonies to see how it all worked. I mean, what was going on. And so, you know, that was, for me, that was me kind of soaking up what all of it was, because I mean, you know, Salem is only part of the story. I mean, it's a major part of the story, but it's not all of it. But I didn't want to tell a story about, you know, the history of witchcraft everywhere. You know, I don't want to, you know, I didn't want to talk about the Spanish Inquisition, which no one expected. I wanted, okay, so that makes me feel better. When someone laughs when I say that, I know they're Monty Python fans, which makes them better in my book. But so I wanted Salem to be the focus, because even though it wasn't a book about Salem, it was still like sort of the climax of everything that was happening, because the witch trials were happening for decades before Salem. That was just sort of when it all sort of exploded, and people started to look at the things that were happening, the witch trials that were happening, the accusations that were being made against people, and began to realize that, you know, maybe they were not what they were being led to believe they were. Now, that wasn't the end of accusations of witchcraft. That went on all the way, well, I mean, in different forms. It went on to the within the last couple of decades, but all in a different form, at least. But at least no one was being persecuted for listening to heavy metal albums backward. You know, they might have been, you know, chastised and accusations made against, but nobody was being hanged for it. So, you know, there are still that kind of thing going on. That mindset is still out there, unfortunately. It's just not quite the same as it was back then. And, you know, when we always say, I mean, I didn't make this up. I forget exactly who the quote comes from, but you know, if we don't learn from our history, we're doomed to repeat it. And so I feel like that if we keep remembering these things that happened, maybe, although it doesn't seem to have worked so far, but maybe we'll stop them from happening in the future. So who knows? We'll see.
I know. It's kind of wild to think about just the history, and like, you know, with the Salem witch trials, it's just one of the most well-known and studied events in American history. And I'm just curious, like, what new insight or perspectives does your book offer on this topic? And how do you think it contributes to, like, our understanding of this era?
Sure. Well, you know, as I said, the trials in Salem were sort of the end of a really long, terrible period in colonial history. The Puritans had been in power in England for a couple of decades. And while they were there, they tried to purge England of anything that was not pure, hence their name. But one of the big things they went after were witches, because according to King James of Scotland, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. That was some translation he put into the Bible, and that's something that they really thought that they should do. And, you know, eventually they lost power there. They said they were being persecuted for their religion in England, so they came to America, where they started persecuting people. So, you know, but when they got here, that, you know, they ran their their communities, nothing like what we expect from American history today. There was no separation of church and state. There was no democracy. It was all according to religious rules and, you know, and hard work and prayer and all that kind of thing. And so, you know, when people were accused of being witches back then, you know, there were hundreds of witch trials that happened before Salem. Most of the accused were women. And it had been that way. They were carrying over a tradition from Europe. It was the same way. You know, women were second class citizens, and they were, you know, property of their husbands and things. So, you know, women were the main target for. I mean, not all. I mean, there were men accused as well, but mostly it was women. Because women were seen as a, you know, a disturbing influence on, you know, anything that went on in a community. So widows were often targeted for being witches, probably because they hexed their husbands. I mean, this is the mindset they had behind it. Women who were very old were also probably witches, because in those days, when your lifespan was a lot shorter, if you made it to old age, you were probably using magic. I mean, these are these excuses. A woman who lived alone with a cat, probably a witch, because cats were witches' familiars who would go out and do all their evil deeds.
I've got
a woman who was, So I always tell people, I said, this is going to be like everyone you know on this list.
We're all witches.
Women
here.
Who were difficult to get along with, or who were strong-willed or outspoken, or talk too much. Those women could be accused of being witches, because women were like children at the time. They were supposed to be seen and not heard.
Women who have podcasts, a woman who had an odd
physical appearance. See, you have a podcast. You're obviously witches. So, you know, a woman who looked weird, she was probably a witch. She talked to herself, probably a witch. Okay. A woman who was known for immoral behavior. That was you were first in line to be, well, okay, but what do you, to hear what immoral behavior was to the Puritans, that usually meant wearing the wrong color of dress or not going to church often enough. Because if you had stopped hanging out with the devil, you wouldn't act like that. That's, I mean, this was the mindset. And the list just went on and on and on. You know, the if you look through the records of people who were accused of being witches in New England at the time, you see a really, what we consider today, very unsettling pattern. You know, these were the outspoken, free-thinking women, women who owned their own businesses, midwives, healers, all frequently accused. If you made someone angry at you, if they felt that you cheated them in some way, or if a neighbor just wanted your land, anything could add up to a witchcraft accusation. Most of those had nothing to do with magic. It would always be, you know, people would come forward and say, oh, well, you know, we disagreed on a boundary line, let's say, with a neighbor, a lady who lives next door. And when we disagreed on this, suddenly my children became sick. My cow stopped giving milk. My chickens stopped laying eggs. She must have put a curse on us. And what would happen is one person would come forward and make this accusation, and then they can get their buddies to come and accuse her of other things too. And what it would usually amount to is, and not everybody was hanged for it, but an unsettling number of people were. Because all it took was a handful of people to make these accusations. And because of the religious fervor at the time, it was easy to believe these people were witches. You know, I mean, the real drive behind it, I mean, aside from the oppression of women and cheating people, was really trying to bring an end to folk magic. Now, when I say folk magic, really, this was mostly just healing in those days. It would be people who used herbs and medicines and things that were not doctors that people would come to. And so what a lot of folk magic was, and still is in a lot of ways, they would use methods to sort of dress up the healing. In other words, you're giving someone an herb that's going to bring down a fever, but if you use some, you know, crystals or a spell that tell them, you know, if you do this, go outside, turn around three times in the moonlight, bury this rock, and make sure you take these herbs, your fever will go away. Well, of course it did, because the herb did its trick, but, you know, the idea behind it was the sympathetic kind of magic. In other words, if someone believes that it's happening, it can't happen. It's mind over matter. But in this case, it was usually the herb doing the trick, but people just to eat some, you know, some weeds, that's not going to convince somebody. But give them something else to do, it's going to work. Well, the thing about the problem with this, now these people brought this stuff over from the old world. That's what they did there. That's what they did in this country. They found new herbs. They found new things that would help to treat people. But this was very common, but the Puritans hated it because it was not coming from God. Because in to them, the only way to get better was to pray. And if you weren't praying hard enough, then there was something wrong with you. That's why you were sick. So the big thing was to try to get rid of this whole thing. And those became the first people they accused. The healers, the folk magic people, the cunning folk, you know, who had been around forever. Now, some of them were able to escape it because they had such loyalty in their villages that people wouldn't turn them in. But if a search was done of their home and they found herbs or crystals or you know, any kind of things that, that could be used for spells or poppet dolls, which is essentially like a New England version of a voodoo doll. It was just a little doll that, you know, was supposed to help you get better or worse, depending on who you were. You either stick a pin in it or you, you know, treat it nicely and the person will get better. But if they found that kind of stuff in your house, you know, you were in big trouble, you know? And so these were the people that got accused, and the Puritans to make it so that their own people who were using folk healers, because that was the medicine at the time, and this thing telling them they couldn't go to these people really divided a lot of towns because people knew that they were beneficial, but they still wanted to go to church. Well, you had to pick one. You had to pick one. So it made it easier to pick one when the Puritans started telling everybody that those people were witches in league with the devil. Now, suddenly, they're the bad guy. Doesn't matter what good they've done, they're witches. And that's how Salem and all of the other places where witchcraft trials were held, that's how they came about, by labels. You know, I mean, witchcraft is one of those things like religion. It's sort of in the eye of the beholder. You know, it depends on the spin you want to put on it. You know, it's all about who's talking about it, who's describing it, who's putting which label on it. It's either religion or it's the occult. It doesn't matter. There's no in between for a lot of people. And so that's what was going on here. So we can look at this in a modern, from a modern perspective, and see what was going on in Salem at the time. And that's what I was trying to do with this book.
Oh no, you absolutely did that. And honestly, I'd be screwed if I was back then. Like I was like, I nailed everything in that list.
Yeah. You know, you're right. Like most as you were saying, it's kind of
that's
funny
the
as you
thing.
Were doing the
and
list.
When you see how bad it was, Yeah.
I love my crystals.
If you made somebody mad at you, you know, they can pick anything. I mean, pick anything. On a daily basis, I could be accused of being a witch just for not even doing anything. You know, I mean, so could you. If you've read a book today, you probably are a witch because you're not supposed to, you're women. You're not supposed to know how to read. You know, what's wrong with you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I own like most of your books. I'd definitely be a witch. All the things I read.
I would be so sorry.
I'm a Troy Taylor follower. I'm definitely a witch. I would not do well then.
No, but it's such a shame that, I mean, I kind of mentioned earlier with like the hysteria and people coming together to against certain individuals. Yeah. And it's such a shame because just like end of day, these people who are like older, they have better hygiene than you did.
like little things like that.
Like, I don't know. I just find it really fascinating.
Exactly.
And you know what I mean? It's just, I find it so interesting. But what I really like in One Night in Salem, you really delve into the psychological and social factors that may have contributed to the hysteria I was mentioning and paranoia that surrounded the witch trials. Can you share some of your thoughts on what might have driven people to accuse and persecute their fellow citizens in this way? I know you kind of touched upon it earlier.
Yeah, like the modernness of
it. Yeah, I mean, you know, this whole thing, you know, it was honestly, I think it was the really strict rules that everyone had to live by and all brought about by the fanaticism of the Puritans, and they created the fear. for people that they had witches and or that there were witches and that they were in league with the devil. And honestly, you know, ordinary people who didn't know any better at the time. I mean, it's not like these people had gone to college or something. And even if they had, they probably still would have heard about witches, you know, so in the time period. And so they would believe whatever they were told. And, you know, when this thing started, you know, you're talking about a couple of girls who, you know, out of boredom, you know, get involved with, the housemaid that works in the home, when Tituba is, you know, showing them some tricks and telling them stories. Nothing harmful. It was all in fun. There was nothing harmful about what she was doing. But for whatever reason, I think probably guilt, you know, they got their friends involved and their friends were excited and they're doing fortune telling tricks and things that Tituba's teaching them. And somebody started feeling guilty and they thought, you know, well, we need to, you know, we probably shouldn't be doing this. And the next thing you know, they're, you know, it's a practical joke gone out of control, you know, and these girls are being pressured to choose someone. You've got to pick somebody, because if you say that you've lied, then you're just as bad as a witch, because you've lied to the pastor, you've lied to your community. If you don't say that you've lied and you keep this going, you're going to have to do something or you're going to be the witch. So they were pressured into choosing someone to be a witch, and so they just picked three outcasts. I mean, a woman who was homeless, a woman who, you know, had wore colored dresses and didn't go to church, and Tituba, because there's the easiest target in town. It's the only free woman of color. Well, she wasn't free, but the only person of color in the community. So she's an easy target. And, you know, everybody knows she's from Barbados and she's probably a witch anyway. So then when, you know, that started and then, you know, they get pressured, she gets pressured into, you know, saying that she's a witch and saying that she saw other people involved, one thing after another happened and more people began to be accused. And people started coming forward with these wild stories about how they'd been cursed or they'd seen the specter of one of the accused women. And, you know, by then the girls are completely out of control. And, you know, everyone who tried to say, you know, these afflicted girls, as they called them, are liars and this is all a fake, the girls would just amp up their performance and make it worse. So if you, you know, it was one of those things where it was a lose-lose. You could say, I'm not guilty and you're accused of being a witch, or you say you're guilty, you're accused of being a witch. Either way, you can end up on the gallows. So there's no easy way out of this. There just weren't, you know. I mean, 19 people in a little over a year's time, 19 people were hanged in a town that started out with just over 200 people in it. So I don't know math. So the percentages there, that's pretty high.
That's
and
high.
Some of these people were upstanding people who just got caught up in this mess. And there were an awful lot of people who went to jail. I mean, there were a couple of hundred people sitting in jail because they're hauling in people from other communities and saying, oh yeah, we saw her dancing in the woods with the devil. So lock her up, you know, and eventually they, you know, went through all the hearings, but then they started to actually put people on trial, which is how people ended up hanged. And then you've got poor Giles Corey, an 80-year-old man whose wife had been hanged as a witch, who just refused to speak in court because they couldn't try him if he didn't. So to get him to speak, they piled stones on him until he died. He lasted for a day and a half. They put a big slab of stone on him and then kept piling rocks on it and trying to get him to talk, and he never did. That was sort of the last straw for people, though. I mean, anybody who saw this thing is questionable. I mean, because, you know, you had a governor who came through who did nothing to help because he was too worried about going to war with Canada, of all things. And, you know, he says, oh, well, you know, I'll just get the trial started. And then once people come into court and start talking about this, they'll just toss all this out. This is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And then off he went gallivanting, you know, up to Canada. And he comes back and he finds out they've hung 19 people. And he's like, what? This is not what I had in mind. And so, I mean, he put an end to it, especially when he found out that the judges that he had allowed to be appointed were allowing people to present what was called spectral evidence in court. Now, spectral evidence is supposedly the ghosts of witches or their familiars that would torment people. But the only people that could see these ghosts were the people who were being tormented, which means these were the people making the accusations. So no one else could see it. So, I mean, evidence is definitely a misnomer here. And he's kind of like, what the hell is this? You know, this has got to stop, you know? And so he stopped that. He, you know, commuted the sentences of everybody that was left, got everybody out of jail. I mean, they all had to go through their day in court, but only a couple of them confessed because by this time they'd been sitting in jail for a year and half of them had, you know, kind of just lost their minds, you know, including my favorite, the five-year-old girl that they locked up for being a witch. That poor thing never recovered, ever. From the time she was locked in prison for a year and never recovered. You know, she just thought that if she said she was a witch, they'd let her go, I guess. I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, that poor thing is, you know, she's had a bite on her hand, you know, and mark on her hand. And she said, oh, yeah, that's where my familiar comes and drinks my blood. And it's like, oh, man, this poor thing. You know, I mean, they could have gotten her to say anything and did. You know, so, I mean, the whole thing was a terrible, terrible thing, but it's almost like it had to happen. Something, I mean, I'm not saying that the people needed to be hanged, but there needed to be this massive attention-getting trial, which is what Salem became, because it was being carried in newspapers in all over Boston, which was only 40 miles away, and then those newspapers would leak down to the rest of the colonies, and they could see the madness that was going on. I mean, it affected all the American colonies at the time. And by stopping them the way that it did, and by saying, you know, these things, this spectral evidence, these things that you can't bring this into court, it had to happen to get this thing to stop. And it did, for the most part, it did stop. I mean, there were, well, and people got distracted with other things by then. You know, we were turning into a country. We had a war. We had, you know, all kinds of things that were going on that steered people away from witchcraft, you know, and times changed.
Absolutely. I can't imagine, like, it's spiraling to that. You know what I mean? Like, you feel like, you know, you're saying this one thing and, like, I could never live with myself if that affected someone.
But the scary thing, though, is what you mentioned so earlier about the paranoia, the hysteria, is that, like, if you defend a witch, you're one of them then. So it's like every, like,
right, exactly.
No,
you're
going to
end up being accused next.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's
right.
Like,
and that's what happened with
lose.
A lot of times.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and for a lot of times, you know, in some of these witch hunting, you know, people who were out looking for witches, I mean, it became an actual job. It became a moneymaker because you know, there were a lot of people that depended on the economy created by witchcraft trials. You had people who were, you know, guys that built gallows or, you know, made rope. You know, you had guys who had to, you know, go around and make the accusations. You had judges, you had, you know, jailers, you had all these people that depended on this. And, you know, and what was even better is if you bring one person in for being a witch and you can get them to confess, they're going to name five other people. So now your money just, it's like a pyramid scheme of witchcraft, you know, more and more money gets made.
Literally.
And so it just became one of these things that it was hard to stop it. You know, that and you know, the religious beliefs of the communities, even people who weren't Puritans that were, you know, just devout Christians were not skeptical enough about what was happening. And so they were willing to go along with it, too. And that's an issue. And it would stay that way for a long time. Even up through the 1800s, even into the early 1900s, you had people in big cities, immigrants that would come over that, you know, had different customs and traditions they'd bring from the old world that got accused of being witches. Now, back then, of course, you were not hanging them or anything, but it did lead to a lot of people being ostracized and run out of town. And, you know, this stuff, it continued on for a long time. I mean, the witchcraft trials and Salem really made a huge impact on our country, one that we don't even understand or how deep it runs, which is why I, again, why I, reasons I wanted to do this book is I wanted to show that, you know, when in the 1980s and early 90s, when the Satanic Panic was going on, it was just another version of the witchcraft accusations. You know, people were being accused of being Satanists, and they were saying that Satanists were stealing all of our children. And, you know, it was on television shows. It was, I mean, it was on Dateline and 2020 and Oprah and Geraldo Rivera. All these shows are doing specials on this. And it's like, you guys are nuts. This is not happening. It's not happening, you know. But boy, I'll tell you what, as a kid growing up at that time, you know, and, you know, your parents, I mean, my parents were pretty religious when I was a kid, and they were, you know, would take away some of our albums because they'd heard that if you played them backwards, there were satanic messages and stuff. And you know, I'm a kid, and I'm not caring about that kind of stuff because it's not, you know. And as you can imagine, with the kind of thing I do, I've always been like this, by the way. So the ghosts, all that true crime, all that stuff, I've always done that. So I mean, you know, I got my own, you know, not necessarily accusations, but you know, you got looked at funny. You know, you did because people really believe this stuff. So it wasn't just, I mean, I blame it on the Puritans for starting it, but it wasn't just them. I mean, it's something that's easily believed by people because, you know, any kind of panic like that or any kind of rumor, I mean, you can go on TikTok and see the same kinds of things. It's not witchcraft or anything like it, but it's let's put, you know, some kind of bug wax in our ear and it'll make us tan. You know, I mean, you see crazy things that people believe and you can't wrap your head around why do people believe this stuff, you know? Who knows? No, you know, it's just human nature, unfortunately.
No, I know. Absolutely. I know. Honestly, like, as you kind of mentioned earlier, the legacy of the Salem Witch Trials has had a lasting impact on American culture and popular imagination, honestly. Why do you think this event continues to capture our fascination and attention centuries later, and what does it say about our relationship to history in the past?
Well, I think, you know, it's a lot of what we've been talking about is that people look back at it and it seems so foreign to us now. And we're baffled by how it could happen, but then we turn around and see the same things repeated, but it's not quite the same because it's witches. It's witches now, we don't think of them the same way that people did back then. It's something fanciful to us. It's culturally more acceptable. I mean, not with everybody, but with most, the general public, at least, we don't think twice about witches. We watch, you know, Sabrina and things on Netflix and stuff. Yeah, right.
Show.
So, you know, it doesn't seem weird because, but listen, it wasn't as easy for witches to become mainstream as they are because, you know, by the 1950s and 60s, people were still thinking about, you know, the Salem witch trials and witches that, you know, killed livestock and stole babies and put curses on people. Or the one that I always thought of when I was a kid was the Wicked Witch of the West. You forget that Glinda was a good witch. You forget about her because she's just in it a little bit. You think about, you know, Margaret Hamilton as the Wicked Witch of the West, and she's scary as hell with her flying monkeys. I mean, that's nightmare fuel to an adult, let alone a little kid. But
Troy,
the one
did
thing,
you not...
though, that changed everything.
Did you not see Wicked? She's got
that's what I'm saying.
She got her arc. She got her character arc.
You look back and it's okay, see?
Sorry,
you know,
continue.
But the reason that Wicked exists, the reason that Sabrina exists, all of these things, is because by the 1960s, witchcraft ended up in the mainstream for one reason only. It is the one thing that changed everything that has to do with witchcraft, and that was the premiere of Bewitched in 1964 with Elizabeth Montgomery. I'm telling you, that is the one cultural thing that changed, that flipped the book on everything. Because now suddenly you had, you know, a witch who wasn't scary, she wasn't threatening. Even her mother, who seemed mean, was hilarious. It's the only person she was mean to was Darren, you know, and so she's the beautiful girl next door, you know, and the only person that you wanted to avoid in that show was Mrs. Kravitz, who really didn't mean anything. She was just nosy and wanted to know what was going on. But so you had Samantha, you had all of her crazy family that would come through, and suddenly witches didn't seem scary anymore. And around that time, by the late 1960s, people were openly talking about being witches, which they had not been doing before. I mean, it was starting to come into our culture in the early 60s with Wicca and that kind of thing, but not people didn't talk about witches. That wasn't until after Bewitched. I mean, even Salem, Massachusetts finally got into the act. I mean, it had never cashed in on its history before this, the witches and the witch trials, but it saw this big spike in tourism after Bewitched did a two-part episode that they filmed in Salem in 1970. And then after that, the Chamber of Commerce decided to embrace the Witch City brand. They even have a statue of Elizabeth Montgomery in the square because that's how important Bewitched was to everything. And so, I mean, that really changed everything, and it's given us a whole different look. I mean, when you have, you know, Bewitched coming out and people start to look at witches differently, it's not as often anymore that you see a movie or a television show, not as often, where the witch is bad. You know, American Horror Story, they're the heroes of the series, right? Also, you end up with like Sabrina, or, you know, every once in a while there'll be a movie like The Witch that comes out, which is phenomenal. That's one of my favorite films. Mm-hmm. And you never really see much of the witch. You just know she's bad. Or is she? Because at the end of the film, when Anya Taylor-Joy embraces Black Phillip, you see her now living her best life with all the other witches in the woods, right? So we've completely flipped the script on what witches are, and all of that came after Bewitched. So Salem still has a big cultural influence on us. It's just different now than it was. I mean, you go to Salem, you hear about the trials, you hear about how unfair they are, and you see the monuments and things and the museums, and then there's witch stuff everywhere. There's happy witches on brooms and things, you know. So there were no witches in Salem, but now there are. And I'm telling you, it was Bewitched that changed everything, which I love, because when I was a kid, I was madly in love with Elizabeth Montgomery. I was like 8 years old, you know, and I just loved her. I still love her. I still watch the show, you know.
That's amazing.
So it was just one of those things that it just changed everything.
Yeah,
so.
It did. It is kind of wild to think how media can change perspective
in a
positive and obviously also a negative as well. Not saying that there's obviously two points to that, but it's kind of wild when you say Bewitched. I was like, that is so true.
Yeah,
like because you do now see her as this, like, you know, like that housewife with the nose and, like, but you know, doing her thing.
Yeah,
like,
the nose and all that.
You know,
her
little, you know.
But she has this relatability now, because before, I think the hysteria connected to uncertainty. It's like, what is this? And unsure. Like, you know, you don't know the causes and effects
of
something. Now, Bewitched is, like, unveiling that in a way that it's like, she's actually just like you,
like,
and
every
me.
Other
with
housewife.
With the hilarious touch of, like, wouldn't you, now you want to be a witch, because she does the house chores with, like, a little her nose. Yeah, like, everyone wants to be
like, I just think about how lucky we are to live in a certain time, not just as women, but even as, like, interests and stuff like that. Like, I think, like, my association with, like, witchcraft and everything is, I mean, as cliche as it sounds, but for me, it's always been Harry Potter. Like, I've always found, like, that magical world.
Sure, sure, same kind of thing. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just fascinating that it's just, like, you know, back then, it's like I could never enjoy a book or even indulge in those thoughts. But, like, now, because of the media like Bewitched, it's opened a world to so many people and interests in the conversation. You know what I mean? Yeah. And like you mentioned earlier, kind of making sure history does not repeat itself in a way of, like, why did this kind of happen? Like, why was the conversation this way? And, like, how we've learned and grown in a different way. I mean, like, thank you to Bewitched.
Shout out
to Bewitched, because I wouldn't have my Harry Potter.
Yeah, exactly. You probably wouldn't. You're probably right, because there just wasn't any media before that. I mean, there were a couple of movies, you know, that where the witches were, you know, pretty wives, you know, Bell Book and Candle and Veronica Lake and I Married a Witch. I mean, you know, those were comedic kinds of things, but they weren't presented in the same way that Bewitched was, which obviously was a comedy, but it really, you know, it showed all the different things that she was doing, you know, and even if it was just making the brooms clean the house for her and things, you know, we all looked at that and thought, oh my gosh, that would be so great. And then when Tabitha was born and the toys were flying around the room, and you're thinking, why didn't that happen to me when I was a kid, you know? And so it's, you know, it really made us want to, you know, be somehow a part of that, you know. know, the same way that Harry Potter did. But, you know, like I said, any of that media we wouldn't have if it wasn't for Bewitched. So we owe a sitcom, essentially, a huge debt of gratitude for a lot of the things we enjoy today. And I don't think it gets enough credit. You know, I've tried to do that. Whenever I talk about this, I always bring up Bewitched and people go, huh, you're right. You know,
yeah.
So.
No, absolutely. I never thought of it until you mentioned it. I was like, that's so true. Yeah. Because we just don't live in a time that it was scorned. You know what I mean? Like, we live in a time of the past Bewitched where it's like, I can't imagine any other way. You're like, you know what I mean? And even if you do, you know, come across a movie where the witch is, you know, maybe a villain, which is not, it does happen.
Yeah.
You're not at all like, you know, having this now narrative of one way. It's both. It's like, there's good and bad witches. Like, there's good and bad people.
Right,
there's
Glinda and, you know, the Wicked
Witch
of the West.
There's Glinda, and there's Wicked Witch of the West.
Yeah,
and guess
I mean,
what?
Really,
we got Wicked
I guess
out
if you
of
look
it.
At it. Yeah, I mean, if you look at it that way, I guess the Wizard of Oz was ahead of its time, but it's true. The problem with it is that it makes Glinda seem so boring. And so, you know, the Wicked Witch is the scary one. She gets all the screen time because she's terrifying, you know? And I think that didn't... You know, it didn't, the good side didn't really catch on with that.
No,
you know, people didn't walk around thinking, oh, I want to be Glinda and float around in a bubble. No one talked about that. They just wanted to be scared of the Wicked Witch and her flying monkeys.
Absolutely.
So, you know.
Oh,
God.
Man. Now, that is petrifying.
It is.
But, I mean, you've written so many other amazing historical books and events and figures with, like, dark and mysterious past, not just One Night in Salem. What draws you to these stories, and how do you approach the challenge to bring them to life for your readers?
Yeah. Well, in the 30 years that I've been doing this, one of the things that I have noticed is that by mixing history with all these dark and mysterious events, that it honestly opens up the history part of it to people who never on their own would have never have cracked a history book. I mean, I've talked to people who didn't even read. You know, I don't even like to read, but I really enjoyed this book. You know, I really got me to sit down and read it, you know? And so that, I think, is kind of one of the most gratifying things about what I do, because I've always tried to, you know, mix the two together. You know, if there's a ghost story to be told, there's undoubtedly a historical event that caused it. And if it's a historical event or a horrific crime, somewhere in there is a ghost story. And by mixing the two together, it will entice people to, I always say it's like the spoonful of sugar, you know, that with your medicine, your history medicine. Now here's a ghost story. That's going to make it go down easier, because you're going to want to read till you get to the ghost story, you know? So it also doesn't hurt that I can't help it. I have to write and tell stories. I mean, I don't know what I would do otherwise. And, you know, with the background that I came from, I think we've even talked about it in the past, with my great-grandfather telling me these horrible, lurid stories that little kids shouldn't hear. But it's, thank goodness he did, because, you know, I wouldn't have my career if I hadn't heard those stories early on. And they've stuck with me. And that's the kind of stuff that I like to write about, I like to read about, I like to think about, you know, so that's how I like to do it. And it helps me connect with people, I think, mostly because of the way that I like to mix things together. I think that's really what it boils down to.
No, honestly, I can attest to someone who's read your books before. Like, I feel like, and why we constantly, not only because we're friends, want you on this show, is because you're always teaching us something. Like, you know, like, I love history. Like, I'm someone who loves to go to museums, loves to learn more. Like, it's something that we've always, like, enjoyed.
We definitely have in common, too.
Yes, like, obviously, hence why we always get along and we always have great banter together. But I've always enjoyed your books because of those sort of elements of, like, you know, intrigue and also learning as well. Like, I think that what's important is people sometimes only see the ghost story, but I love that you always take a step back to be like, there's history there. Or there's a reason why this lore, you know, spiraled into this story, you know, which I think is always so fascinating.
Right,
but I think the topics that you highlight are obviously so fascinating, because there's, as human nature, in human nature, we are just drawn to the dark in some way. Do you know what I mean? Like, I know I am.
Yeah.
I don't know what that says about me. Maybe I shouldn't actually generalize. I am drawn to the dark. And so your stories really fascinate. fascinate me because it's like you mentioned, a lot of these historical events do spark a lot of other storytellers like you in so many different ways and mediums. Mm-hmm. You know, like we've had you on before. Yeah. We've talked about Buddhism and how media, you know, twist it in a dark way. And then you enlighten us with the historical events being like, it's actually not that dark, like anything in life, you know?
Right.
And with this, for instance, it's like you tell us the history about, you know, witches. There were no witches. People were awful. But
you just had a really shitty neighbor.
You just had a real shit ass neighbor.
Yeah, exactly.
But with that aside, there is some truth behind some of these. Well, I mean, there is truth behind these events in a way that's like, these were just healers. Yeah. These are people, and how it's really evolved into the media that we see today is so amazing. So I really love that the story has always evolved since history, but you've always bring people back into the reality of what it really stems from. Because you can appreciate the story itself. Like you might, this might not, you know, it might be a movie or whatever, but I understand where it came from. And I'm the kind of person when I watch or read anything, I love behind the scenes. Like I love to figure out how it started and what really became of this. Because it seems like, this is wild, you know? And then you find out X, Y, and Z happened.
And sometimes I think the original story can be just as more interesting. Where I'm like, why would they change that? Or like, this is so much more, there's more depth here, you know? Like, the Hollywood
Yeah, the true story is sometimes so much better. And that's one of the things I always try to do is if there's a story and it's sort of a legendary story. And, you know, when you start, I love to dig into that stuff. And then you start to find that it's not even right. You know, we've been hearing this all this time, and that's not the correct story. There's nothing I love better than correcting the story. It's it's not debunking anything. Yeah, it's just actually the real story is always, always better. Yeah. You know, that's the thing. And that's the one of the things that always has driven me crazy about some of this stuff is people will just keep telling the wrong story over and over again because they think it's dramatic. And it's not, you know, it's not true. And the telling the truth, the true side of the story is always so much better. Yeah. And, you know, it's just, there were so many things about Salem, you know, that just were of such interest to me, but there've been how many books? I didn't need a blow by blow of Salem. I didn't need to write that. That's been done. That's been done many times. What I wanted to look is how it impacted everything else, you know, and how, what happened afterward and what happened before, how do we even get to that point? And then how do we get to where we are today? That's what I wanted to do with it. And I think that, you know, people that have read it, that have given me good, you know, feedback on it, that's, they got it. They understood what I was trying to do, which is, you know, it makes you feel good that you've accomplished something, even if it's a handful of people who go, hey man, I get it, you know, or who go, oh God, Bewitched. That's the answer, you know.
Yeah, so, it's,
Bewitched is always the answer
to everything. Bewitched is the answer to everything. No, but I think that's why I like I mentioned earlier, I love your books and I trust your books so much and your source is because the amount of research you do, but the questions you ask to get there too.
Yeah.
It's like you're very inquisitive on the things you want to uncover that even as someone who's reading it, I didn't realize I needed that answer until shown to me where I was like, that's a really good point. Like, oh my God. Like, so I appreciate your intelligence and your thoughtfulness throughout every book that you write and I get to enjoy it and have on.
Yeah, I feel so happy that we get to have you on every year's our new Troy segment.
It's like, my friend is so smart. I get to boast how smart my friend is.
Yeah, for this entire episode.
For an hour, yeah.
Oh, my God. But as I know, this is, which makes me so sad, this episode is over.
Almost.
But I wanted to, you know, let you at the end, you know, share with our listeners what you're currently working on and any other upcoming books or events that you're excited about to share.
Yeah, I, well, I mean, you know, always doing some traveling, but, you know, by fall, I'm mostly locked into home, except for a trip that I'm taking to Salem with my two favorite twins.
So
I'm sure that by the time this airs, I don't know, I think this will probably air after we've gone, but that's okay. So at least people will know that we were there, but, I'm always writing books. I've got new stuff coming out all summer. I did a book with a friend of mine from upstate New York and she kind of specializes in, like Victorian mourning things like, you know, all the customs and traditions of postmortem photographs and that kind of thing. But she also does a journal called The Feminine Macabre, and it's and she's up to her like her fifth or sixth journal, but it's all women who write, and it's only women. There's no men allowed. But I've been doing a I always want to like submit something under a fake name, but I don't because she knows me too well. But I've been doing this series for a few years called Hell Hath No Fury, and it's about women murderers and victims, the ghost stories. And so book three is well, it will be out by the time this airs. And I asked her, Amanda Woomer, I asked her to co-write it with me because with the Feminine Macabre and everything, it made a nice tie-in. So so that came out. I'm doing a couple of books on Illinois gangsters. I did one on Chicago, and it's a new edition is coming out. But I also did one on, or the one that's coming out that's brand new is one I did on Southern Illinois gangsters, which is like... Everybody thinks 1920s, you think about Al Capone and Chicago and the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. These people in Southern Illinois were nuts. They had an all-out war going on. They were building tanks. They were dropping bombs from airplanes. I mean, there is just as many murders that went on during Prohibition in Southern Illinois as there was in Chicago. They never get the attention. And they're also sort of hilarious because it's just like one... misfortune after another with these people. I mean, it's just crazy. Trying to murder their rivals by dressing up as women and going into the hospital. I mean, it's some crazy stuff. I've got that coming out. And my Christmas book, I try to do one for Christmas, probably really better for Valentine's Day, but I'm doing it for Christmas. And it's the title isn't decided, but the working title is Love Gone Wrong. And it's like killer couples. Like, you know, bad relationships. Sometimes it's one or the other killing the spouse or boyfriend, girlfriend. Yeah. Other times it's just couples who, you know, go into business together, eliminating people. So I usually do like a dinner presentation on it every year. Valentine's Day, because that's the perfect time, right?
Yes.
So I'm doing a book on it. So that's my plan to have that out for Christmas. So I'm always busy, I'm always writing something. So,
and we're always getting your book. So I'm excited when you tell me. I'm like, all right, the date, when do I pre-order this?
And I always get excited.
I do. I always get so excited because you always write in the book as well.
You
so,
do.
Like, I love getting that little personal touch. I'm like, oh, Troy.
I know. I appreciate it every time when you're like, two of my favorite twins. I was like, oh, Troy.
I look forward to it every time.
I love it.
And I just want to say again, thank you so much for being on. Like, we enjoy it every year and expect another one next year.
Fun.
Yeah, I might as well book you next year.
Yeah, yeah, right. Come now. Come up with a new one. We'll figure it out.
Yes,
so.
Please. I mean, you already gave us some content already by saying those three books could be the next 3 years.
yeah, there you go.
It was so nice having you on, Troy. Thank you again for being on.
Well, thanks. Yeah, no, I always love it. So I always look forward to it.
Yeah. See ya. Bye.
All right. Bye.
Look at you. You made it to the end. Now that we have you here, we'd like to do a little shameless plug-in.
Of course.
And encourage you to follow us on all social platforms at
The Vogel Twins.
If you want to know more about, like, in-depth about our travels, definitely check out our website, thevogeltwins.com.
Thanks for tuning in.
Bye.